This is the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast from Advanta IRA, where we show you how to explore investments beyond Wall Street and open your eyes to new options for your portfolio. It's time to take control and give yourself the freedom to choose where you invest your money.
Welcome on to another edition of the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. As always, my name is Alex Perney, and today we are very pleased to welcome on Brett Schottkavis, who we're going to be covering some pretty undercovered or maybe not as much information on them out there as viable investments, but assisted living facilities, or ALFs, is what we're going to be kind of referring to them as during this presentation. More often than not, people just kind of think of ALFs and assisted living facilities as the kind of the place where grandma goes, or, you know, just kind of end of life care, but they don't really think about it as a viable investment option. I think we've had one podcast guest on in the past where we've covered this, but we're going to be covering kind of a different market segment and how people can understand this as something where, while yes, it is a very valuable service that's being put out there to the broader scope of the population, but it's also something that you can make money on. It. You can be doing something good and make money at the same time. These things don't have to be mutually exclusive. So Brett, thank you very much for being on with us today. In our pre-call, we kind of had an interesting discussion about how you kind of, your pathway into ALF. So maybe give us a little bit of background about yourself, how you kind of came to be in the world of ALF investing, and then we'll go into your specific investment criteria and your thesis behind why this is a good investment for you.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me on, Alex. So I've been a real estate investor for about 10 years and pretty much fresh out of college, was waiting tables, you know, read Rich Dad Poor Dad and was like, there's got to be something better out there, right? And my next door neighbor was a realtor, kind of wholesaler kind of guy. And he was like, hey, I can teach you how to flip houses, right? And my wife and I, we'd gone through and we were fixing up our first house. And it was like, we bought it in like 2011. So it was going up and everything. We're like, cool, we can sell this thing. We can figure out how to flip houses, get into the real estate game. And so we did. We sold our house and jumped headfirst into it, realized that our neighbor didn't know anything about investing. So we went and figured it out on our own. And that was really where we started with this, right? I spent about 8 years full-time investing, built a team and in California, flipped a couple hundred houses, bought a bunch of different rental properties and things like that. And I had this like urge for, I wanted to combine real estate with something that legitimately made a difference, right? Like we were going and we're buying up the worst houses with druggies and hoarders and all sorts of gross things, right? And you can say, okay, you're fixing up the neighborhood, making it better, but like you weren't legitimately making a difference. You weren't like, there was no one-on-one. And so I was trying to combine the two things that I loved, which was real estate and helping people. And I'm like, how do I make this work? So, it was a few years of me exploring different options, looking into, you know, sober livings and group homes, looking into assisted living and end of life care. And then we came across this thing, you know, residential assisted living. And so we kind of played with it for a little bit of time. We got some coaching on it. We went and like toured some of these places that were doing like the 6-bed and the 8-bed. And, you know, you can actually, you know, do those things pretty easily, convert a house and such. And I just didn't see the numbers, right? Like from a business perspective, like when I'm putting down the income and I'm looking at full-time staffing and you know, operations and a chef and all these things, I'm like, man, like I can see how I can run it personally and like maybe live there and maybe make a salary for myself, but I don't know how to do this as a scalable investment. And so we kind of put it on the back burner until realistically we went and kind of just figured out a whole new niche. And so I call those the assisted living mansion, but we can kind of work our way into that. But that's ultimately what we do now is we build these new construction, 10,000 square feet, super BA assisted livings for end of life. They are ultimately, my goal is I am matching all the care, service, amenities that you could get at the 4-story big smelly building you know, grandma hates, they don't want to go into, but you can get all the end of life care there. You can get private rooms, you can get a chef, you can get a salon. And I'm like, why can't I just do that on a smaller, more intimate level? So our model is we build these for 16 beds, right? 16 grandmas and grandpas, private room, private bath, And instead of having like this big facility, or on the other side, having a small little house where you convert the garage, we started building these new construction mansions that are purpose-built, that look and feel like a home, but nonetheless, they're purpose-built. They're built for ADA. They have the roll-in showers. They have an office. There's a salon. You know, there's a place for the doctors to come in and do all the home health and hospice, all those kind of things. And it's like, okay, I think this is a sweet spot in the market where I can kind of carve out a niche on this, because I'm not too small, right? I'm not having that little dinky RAL model where I'm buying a 4-6 bedroom house, converting the garage, and really kind of being an owner operator, kind of a slave to my business. And I'm not the dinosaur, right? That's going extinct to this, you know, 100-bed facility that nobody wants to be in, especially in a post-COVID world. So that's kind of the short version of how we got into this. I wanted to do something that legitimately helped people, but that grew my my passive income. It created an opportunity for me to build really incredible amounts of wealth on the real estate side, and then at one day, you know, after scaling, be able to exit this game.
Fantastic. So let's kind of, you know, the best place to start with anything is kind of at the beginning, right? So, sure. You know, it's a kind of a tale as old as time with a lot of people on our podcast, and not that's anything bad. There's people that do very well with it, but, you know, people get involved in real estate. They get their foot in the door. They have that first flip. They, you know, get the bug of saying, wow, this, you know, doesn't take an advanced degree of, you know, you don't need to go to MIT to figure out, you know, that people need places to live, or there's a need for housing. And if you can buy, sell, utilize something, you can make money on it. Now, that is the grossest oversimplification of real estate that I can possibly come up with. But suffice it to say, it's what most people get in the door. It's kind of a very similar situation to yours. And then you talked about kind of scaling that from 2011 on up for the next, I suppose, like 8 or 10 years. Now, what was kind of the catalyst that, you know, first you said, you know, I'd like to be investing with more purpose. You know, I can certainly make money and improve my own franchise in life, but I want to, you know, go out into the world and, you know, leave your mark, if one would say. So, you know, that's, you know, maybe if you can talk a little bit about what, maybe if there was a defining moment, or if it was just kind of maybe some malaise with just the ins and outs and wanting something more that kind of initially helped you transition into thinking about doing something different.
So it was really me chasing this idea of I want to do a bigger deal. And, you know, you get into residential real estate, and you can do lots of little deals, right? And sometimes, you know, you get to a place where, you know, we were doing 50 deals a year and we're making great money, but not necessarily life-changing money for that much work, right? Do that many deals. And it was like, well, you know what? I'm building my confidence. I'm building my skill sets. I'm learning all these different things. Like, how come I can't just do one big deal, right? Like, what if I want to do one big deal a year or every 2 years, like multi-million dollar deals where I can profit that? Like, that's what I started searching for. I'm like, how do I do that? And that's like kind of my, you know, I love this game, playing the real estate game, building, you know, wealth and playing with numbers. But then the other side of it was like, okay, if I want to do that, how do I do something where I'm legitimately making a difference in my city? Where I can show my kids like, hey, here's what dad does, right? Like, it's not about only the numbers. I'm legitimately like taking care of people and changing people's lives. And so I didn't have the answer right away. It actually took me a couple years of searching for the right opportunity. And I saw this RAL thing and I thought, okay, maybe that's it. But I couldn't make those numbers work, you know, to be able to say, okay, here's a big enough deal that's life-changing that I can exit the rat race and those kind of things. So it took me a little bit of kind of finessing and I guess thinking outside the box and thinking, well, if the big smelly facility that has 60 beds can do this, right? Like, why can't I do the same thing? Why can't I take the same zoning type? Why can't I get the same license type? And instead of having 60 beds, why can't I just have 16? Because that's more intimate. I can provide fantastic care. I can still afford full-time around the clock staff and a manager and a chef and have private rooms and be more upscale. And again, like, maybe it sounds simple if I just say it in that perspective. It wasn't simple for me to figure that out because I didn't know anyone who was doing that. There was only two options when I got into this. It was the big smelly facility and it was like the little 6-bed RAL. I'm like, I don't really see a path on either of those things.
Yeah. And just for people that are, you know, maybe new to this and some of the terminology, RAL standing for residential assisted living, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
Okay, great. So if we're saying like ALF or RAL, if you're kind of new to this, there's a lot of in real estate, there's a lot of acronyms, but especially when you start getting into like operational utilization of real estate, the acronyms become kind of word soup. So just to make sure people are kind of staying up to date with us. So it's kind of interesting that, you know, this was really a play towards scalability of your, of your time and effort, right? You know, a lot of people, mm-hmm. when I talk to them, especially in the commercial real estate realm, it's, you know, they invest in real estate, they like it, but it's the throughput, it's the scalability of it. You know, the amount of work that you need to put into acquiring 10 houses in a year. Well, if you can do that and acquire two pieces of commercial real estate, well, you know, you're automatically, well, I shouldn't say automatically, the potential is there to scale much quicker with the same amount of work and to make more money. So who doesn't want to make more money for their time? So it's interesting that that was kind of the initial catalyst, was that scalability look. And more often than not, people just automatically kind of go, commercial real estate, I want to buy an apartment building. you know, in today's real estate world, that's kind of the, you know, the big push out there. That's the big shiny, sexy thing that people look towards. Now, you said you looked at a lot of other stuff between sober living houses and different things. Why didn't some of those other ones make the cut? You know, everyone always wants to take care of grandma, but like you said, it was a scalability thing. So maybe what was the reason that some of the other ones didn't make the cut for what you're looking for? Was it simply just the numbers on them? Was it the acquisition cost or just trying to find zoning permitting? What were some of the factors that went into not going towards one of those other things that definitely, you know, was more impactful with your investing?
So I tried sober living. I actually ran one for about a year and a half. And, you know, we had a house. We had actually a duplex that we purchased. We converted it, got furnishing, had a live-in manager, built out a system, was like, okay, can I scale this, right? And ultimately, I came at it from the perspective, okay, let me put this together so I can grow this and scale this. And I mean, we're legitimately helping people. Like, we were taking people, mostly men, off the streets that had addiction and things like that. If they were not in my house, they were literally living under a bridge, no food, no showers, doing that, right? So we were literally bringing in people and helping them. And that really got me excited. And then it's like, okay, can I scale this? Can I take care of my family? Can I get to my financial goals through this model? And the answer was no, right? But I had to learn it myself, the kind of the school of hard knocks there. And ultimately we got to a place where like, we had a bunch of dudes there. We were legitimately trying to help them. We had someone living there running it, and they were, you know, doing drugs in the house and starting fires in the house, literally starting fires in the house. That was my final straw. Like, the manager called and said, hey, this guy is tweaked out in the bedroom. The bedroom's on fire and he is literally like hand across his face in front of the fire. Like, he is out of it. And so they pulled everybody out, put out the fire. And I was like, okay, no, we're closing this thing down. We are selling it. We're going to look into something else here. So we tried, you know, a few different things. I actually got into like mobile home investing. At one point, that wasn't for me. And, you know, we did well with our flips and, you know, purchasing, you know, Burr and all that kind of stuff. But again, it was like, okay, how do I go bigger and do just one or two deals a year? And I never really got into big apartments. We did a lot of smaller multifamily stuff, but I think I was really drawn to this idea of helping seniors. And actually, when we opened our first assisted living, my grandma was a first person we were able to move in. And she actually just passed a few months back. But to literally be able to take care of your own family for years and know that they're getting the best of the best care, I think that just really resonated with me. I wanted to do something legitimate that made a difference for my family and for others around.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would also think, at least from my, you know, kind of own personal thoughts, is that, you know, from the sober assisted living space, you know, you always want to be able to do this stuff long term, and notwithstanding dealing with people, you know, they're certainly going through probably the worst parts of their life. But, you know, the ultimate goal with assisted living is sober living is that you would never need it. You know, there's, you know, the end goal of the perfect world is that doesn't exist. You know, grandma's still going to exist. People are still going to get old. But the idea is that, you know, hopefully one day we wouldn't have a need for them. So, you know, hopefully in a perfect world, your investment isn't phased out, if you will. But yeah, that's definitely a good point. You know, it's, you know, there's a reason that people, you know, can certainly make money in doing certain things. And there's a reason that people own the D and C class apartment buildings in, you know, underserved communities. But there's a certain, you know, avatar of people that you're going to be dealing with, and you have to have the stomach for it. So, you know, it's kind of interesting that that's the first place that you would go. And then I think it is kind of a, you know, a much more you know, a very kind of logical progression in what you're telling me of going from the sober living to the assisted living model. Now, and also for the edification of our listeners, you said you're from in California. Were you doing this all local to you in the state of California?
Yeah, this was all in California. So we after we sold our sober living, it was really, like you said, it was the next progression. Like, okay, let's seriously consider this other type of care, right? End of life care for seniors, people with dementia. And it happened to just be, there was an opportunity. We were, my wife and I, we had young kids. We were ready to move out of California. And we did this prior to COVID, which, you know, we beat a lot of people out of California. But, you know, just like everyone else, right? Like, well, let's leave California for some of these other states. And we were able to do that with this opportunity, knowing that, hey, okay, we're going to move to Texas, and I'm outside of Austin, to say, okay, let's go open our first assisted living. So ultimately, we moved here with the intention of, we want to have our, you know, our lifestyle a different way, but let's do this in a more business friendly state.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of you know, a very, very common tale. Well, surprise you, it's the one of two places. You either land in Texas if you're from California, or you land in Florida from California. So right. Me being in Florida, we're bummed that we don't have you, but no, Texas definitely is a great state for doing business. So let's talk about that first deal. So, you know, we've kind of covered the trajectory of how you got into real estate, you know, what brought you into assisted living, which, you know, I can only imagine probably the more stories that you have from the sober living days. But, you know, when you set out for this, you know, you learn a lot on your first deal. And that's what I like to cover with people when we're talking about, you know, kind of the start of what they're doing is, you know, one, what did that deal look like? You know, from the numbers to finding the property to issues you ran into, and what lessons did you learn that, you know, I'm never going to make that mistake twice kind of realizations that you had doing that first deal?
You know, I thought it would be a lot easier than it actually was. And again, coming from the perspective of a business person, and I've been through a lot of hard things and done a lot of difficult deals. But I still, like, it was still like 3 or 4 times more difficult than I thought it was going to be. I'm pretty sure like the entire like first 6 months, I was literally praying or fingers crossed that the city wasn't going to email me and say, hey, no, you can't do this, right? Like, there's so much. I think the biggest challenge right off the bat is finding the right location. It's so difficult to be able to do this because most cities do not want you to do this. Most areas don't want an assisted living. Like, they come out with pitchforks, like, not in my neighborhood kind of thing. And it's like, really? But I'm just trying to take care of some grandmas and grandpas here. So ultimately, we ended up buying a house and demoing it down to the studs and then doing a big addition. So our first assisted living, it's called Platinum Resort. It's in Georgetown, Texas. It is 15 bedrooms, 12 bathrooms. It's about 6,300 square feet. So we took this old ranch style house. It was in an area that was kind of in a non-zoned area. And so I was able to not have challenges with residential zoning and things like that in this area. But we doubled the size of it and really just gutted the thing down. And man, from the zoning issues to you know, the planning and zoning issues, the city council meetings, all that stuff before I could even get permits. I mean, it was like 12 plus months of going through all these hoops, and no one seemed to really want me in their area, right? To then dealing with that fire marshal. Go ahead.
Just real quick. So, was that 12 months post acquisition, or is that 12 months post demo?
It was about. Yeah, it was maybe 9 months post demo, and wow. it was just back and forth with these different things. Where again, I was in an unincorporated area. So they said, hey, really, there's no permits. You just go and do this one thing. And then they kind of come back and said, no, well, there is, you know, we do have your hooks in you because, you know, you're not in the city limits, but the fire marshal responds to this area. So now you have to pull these permits and go through all these hoops. And it was like, well, it was just so ambiguous, right? Like, on the first time, I wish I had a checklist with like, here's every question you need to ask, right? Like, now I have that checklist, right? I go in, and I'm you know, finding the right zoning type, going through my due diligence, talking to the fire marshal, getting all these things. But learning all of these things, I think the fire marshal was the biggest thing that threw me. All the different types of fire suppression systems, the different types of volume of water that I'm going to need. Man, I tell you what, like, when you are putting in a commercial fire suppression system, the amount of water and pressure that you need is astronomical. And it literally, like, XNA is like most areas. You literally physically can't do it if you have this certain type of fire sprinkler system that you need. And so there was just a lot of different lessons there, and a lot of expensive lessons. I didn't know these things. And then if I didn't make some of these things, you know, regarding fire sprinklers and suppression, then I had to do like this extra thing, get a tank and a pump. And like each one of these is like $100,000 for some of these things. It's like, okay, well, I went in with this budget, right? And it literally at least doubled. By the time, you know, I finished my rehab, I had to sell 2 or 3 rental properties to be able to like finish my rehab. I'm like, oh my gosh, like what the school of hard knocks, the things I learned on this first round were pretty intense.
Yeah, that's a heck of a holding cost when you're talking about the holding costs in terms of properties you had to liquidate. That's I think right. That's kind of a new one that I've heard. It's like, yeah, this holding cost was X number of dollars in 2 sold houses on the Monopoly board. It's
like, exactly, man, right.
That's rough. And yeah, no, fire suppression stuff is crazy. I had a guest on here that I was talking to one time that it was a certain locale that they had to, it was one of those things where after they had done everything, they were really careful on how much of the property they were, the commercial property they were renovating. They came back in after the scope of work and like, oh, nope, you exceeded 25.25% renovations. Now you have to bring the whole fire code up to, up to fire code. And he said that the craziest thing that he went through on that, was that most of the infrastructure was there, but his bill for wiring in the actual like smoke alarm and control panels have to use like a mineral coated wire. He's like, I've never seen an electrical panel cost that much money. It's like a $40,000 electrical panel with this special wiring. And yeah, that's, it can get pretty crazy when you start talking about fire suppression systems. You're the second person that's ever mentioned that on the podcast. Oh, yeah. And I just thought it was, I never would have thought that, you know, you think, you know, a couple grand, 3, 4, 5 grand at tops for a panel. It was like, nope, add another zero onto that. It's like, wow.
Yeah. It's like a wedding, you know, like it's a white dress or it's a wedding dress, right? It's the same thing, but it's 10 times the cost. It's the same thing for the whole industry with fire suppression. It's just metal pipes, man, with water in it. But no, I can 10X the cost on it because it's, you know, it has to be approved by the fire marshal. So it's one of those things where you just got to know going into it. They're going to charge you a whole bunch.
So yeah, to get back on base, so you buy the house, you think, okay, this is great. They say, hey, it's unincorporated, not going to be an issue. And then the fire marshal comes knocking. It's like, nope, you got to do X, Y, and Z. So you're turning the corner, you're getting all this stuff done 9 months post demo. Did you open the doors at that point, or did you just start construction? Like, when did you actually start being able to occupy and bring occupants into the building?
Yeah, so we actually opened. So we got through that, the hurdles there with fire marshal, and then it was mostly smooth through construction, which was about another 6 or 7 months, which led perfect timing for COVID to start. So we literally opened just a couple months after COVID started. And man, I'll tell you what, this was, you asked my wife, she's still traumatized from COVID and what we had to do. I mean, like literally like, staff would call in, get COVID, and then for 2 weeks, right? Like there was, you couldn't. So we were there literally during this time for, I mean, sometimes you work 24 hours, right? Because like the staff couldn't come in. And so it was super hard. We had a manager who was running it for us, but nonetheless, like it would have been all normal-ish. It's a hard industry regardless. But when you throw COVID on top of that and people not being able to come in, and then how like all the grandmas and grandpas, they were literally locked into the room. Like you're like, we would play bingo and they'd be like at the door and you're like yelling B6 down the hall. It was such a terrible, terrible time for several months, at least Texas, right? We were only locked down for like 6 or 8 weeks or something like that. Then they can come out, but there was still for, you know, a year or so, all these crazy rules with, you know, N95s and face shields and all this kind of stuff and waivers. And, you know, even, you know, their family couldn't come visit for several months, right? Like the grandmas were in there. You know, sometimes they would pass away. Like if you couldn't come visit them, it was a really horrible situation. So I think my grit level has like 10X'd because of this business and through COVID. Like I feel like, man, you know what? This is a 24/7, 365 business. I can pretty much start anything now. And perspective wise, it would be way easier than this.
Absolutely. So notwithstanding COVID, and, you know, now we're at the point where, you know, we got doors open, we got people coming in. Operationally, these things, you know, you have to deal with a lot of different stuff. You have to deal with medical, memory care, a lot of ADA compliance, I'm assuming, too, with regard to, you know, while these people aren't necessarily maybe disabled from a legal sense, they still need to utilize a lot of the things that would go in, you know, such as, you know, long, long entryways and, you know, maybe some widened doorways, lowered toilets, zero entry showers. Was there any other kind of big things as far as like operationally that were kind of like an aha moment on that first one that you were like, you know, you mentioned checklist, you know, what else did you put on your checklist after that first deal, you know, notwithstanding the purchase and everything, but just from an operational standpoint, some things you learned along the way in that first one?
You know, so our niche is really end of life care. And most of our residents, I refer to them not as residents or patients, but as grandmas and grandpas. So most of our grandmas and grandpas, they're like 90, 95 years old. And ultimately, the thing that I think is best, my biggest aha moment here, it all comes back to income. There is a lot of work and help and care that you need to take care of these people and actually do it right. The amount of staffing that you need, having a manager there, bringing in all the outside services from home health to hospice, having a private chef and your own bedroom and a salon, all of these things you legitimately need to have fantastic care. And all of those things are expensive. So really the biggest learning lesson for me was all like a numeric thing. Our whole niche is we really want to match as far as pricing, the most expensive new construction, you know, four-story ALF that comes into town, right? When they build these new monstrosities with the independent living and then the assisted living, the memory care, we want to be competitive to them. And when we first kind of got into this, I think we were just trying to figure these things out. We were trying to survive. And you don't anticipate what the costs are going to be, right? Like when you're just, especially if you're coming at it from the perspective of, oh, I'm going to have a residential assisted living. I'm going to convert a house or maybe have shared bedrooms. And you start having these lower bed rates and you don't have enough volume of residents. I mean, you literally cannot afford the staff that you need to take care of your grandmas and grandpas. So that's my biggest thing now. And what we have changed as we are growing our business, we only build new construction now. So I took what I did there, right? We had that house. We did a big addition and doubled it. Took that idea and that model. I'm saying, okay, how can I scale this? So right now we're building four of them. We bought 8 acres. We're building four, I call them mansions, right? Memory care mansions. So now it's like, okay, how do I bring in all of the different care, amenities, things that you want at end of life and bring it into like a neighborhood, really, right? Like I want to turn down a street and not have like the red curve and the parking lot and the portico. But you turn down our street into our neighborhood and it looks like a custom home builder came in and built like four BA houses. You know, they just like, oh, who are these next door neighbors that like, who's this little mini neighborhood with a bunch of rich people? Like that's what we're doing now. And we take those lessons and we say, okay, you know, here's new construction. It's built, purpose built. It's built ADA. It has, you know, private rooms and a chef and a salon and all of the care you can get at the big facility. So I think, you know, really trying to come up with that niche is what I learned. It took me, you know, a good year or so to figure out that I needed to be competitive, not against the other smaller or the other residential ones, but to be competitive against the big facilities. Right? Nobody wants to be in these big facilities anymore. Usually the grandma start in the apartment style and then they decline. A couple of years later, they move to assisted living and then they decline some more. They move to memory care. And by the time they've declined a couple times and been through this funnel, like they can't stand the care that you receive at a big facility, right? They're turning through managers, they're turning through caregivers. And it's like, well, if you can do this more intimate and provide the exact same care or services, but do it on a 1-16 level instead of a 1-60 level, then I think that's really where the future of this is going. This is where everyone wants to go.
Yeah, no, it's kind of like the analogy of what most people always harken back to. It's like, hey, you know, you can get real high quality, you know, produce at a Whole Foods, but no one really wants to go battle the lines and do that. If you have a farmer's market that gives you amazing stuff at a much more intimate feel, you know, maybe not the best at analogies, but I think it kind of drives the point home of saying, you know, you offer a competitor to a much more intimate option to something that is a very intimate thing in life. You know, the end of term care is not, you know, something to be taken lightly. And if you can give a much more, you know, palatable approach to it, where you're not driving up to, you know, something that looks like a housing project, it can be the nicest thing inside, but you know, no one wants to pull up to that. No one really wants to live in it if you don't have to. If you can live in a house, if you've been living in a house for years and years and years, I think that's definitely kind of an interesting take on that market. And it's surprising that, you know, obviously if you're doing it, there's probably, that's an underserved portion of the market that, you know, it's always kind of fun to think that, hey, it's like, why has no one really done this or done it to scale? You know, I'm sure that's probably kind of what you ran into, is that either people weren't doing it or weren't doing it to scale, right?
Yeah. There, so there's people who are getting close, right? And so again, I'm in Texas and it's pretty common. They'll take these 16 bedroom facilities and put two next to each other, do one assisted living, one's memory care. And so I actually call those small boxes because they're just like a big box facility, right? A big box has 100 beds or something like that. These are just small boxes. They literally look and feel the same. You walk in and you feel the oppression and like the gross feel and smell. And they have the long hallways and like the nursing station. Instead of having like, you know, this big 100 bed, they just thought, okay, let me put two 16 beds next to each other. So like you'll see big corporate come out and build these things and they're trying to do it, but no one's really doing it like this, right? Like no one's saying, okay, let me actually build a mansion. Let me build something that people legitimately want to move to. So honestly, most of our residents, they are not coming from home. They are coming from the big smelly facilities, right? Like I think if you're getting into this space, you don't have to find somewhere that is underserved, right? Where you have, there's like, you know, a surplus of seniors. Realistically, it's like they're just going to move from the big facility after 1 or 2 years of getting bad care and come over to what we're doing. So I think this is really the future of where the market is shifting, definitely towards more intimate and definitely towards more on the luxury side.
Awesome. Now, before we kind of get in maybe some of the numbers and, you know, how these things work and, you know, between, you know, financing, investment, that kind of thing, is the reason that you really transitioned from, you know, buying something, gutting it and rebuilding it to new construction simply the red tape that you had to go through? It's just easier to kind of build it from the ground up with all that baked in. Or was there maybe some other reasoning or some more deeper details into why you like to focus on the new construction side? You know, notwithstanding the fact that when it's new construction, you get to pick every single thing that you want, besides, you know, yeah, having to kind of work around the structure of what you're doing.
So there's two really big challenges that are pretty much deal killers when you're coming at the conversion option. And a lot of people try and do this, right? They try and take the house and convert it. So the first one is zoning. Usually, I mean, 90% of the time, you're going to go in, if you have a house, right, it has residential zoning, and you're going to go to planning and zoning, and they're going to say, okay, cool, yeah, you can do that. Yeah, you can do it for six beds, right? Like anything above six, no, you have to be in this other zoning over here. That's commercial zoning or some other type, right? Like you want to convert a house. Okay, cool. You can do that, right? You're just stuck at six. And then you just put the pencil to paper and you're like, oh, but if I am at six, I make a profit of negative 6,000. Okay, that doesn't make sense. So that's the really one of the hugest things there. The second part of this, even if you bought a house like I did that was in an unincorporated area, it was in the right zoning type, ADA comes in and nothing is ADA, right? Like all of your doorways have to move, all of your walls have to move, like none of your bathrooms will be able to stay. The amount of space you need for ADA is crazy. Like when you start going looking at the code, like everything needs to be ADA, right? Your transition from your front door, your back door, everything. And realistically, for when I did it, I literally took this house. And again, this is why my rehab doubled. I thought I'd be able to keep most of it. I literally had to move all the walls, right? And then like re-engineer the whole thing and put beams everywhere. And none of my hallways were big enough. None of the doorways were big enough. No bathroom got to stay, right? It was like, oh my goodness. Yeah, it's so much easier. And if you talk like just on a strictly cost basis, if you're going to buy a house and convert it and do an addition, the cost is literally about the same as building new construction on an average like price per square foot. It might be a little faster. You might be done in, you know, 3 or 6 months sooner because of planning and zoning and all those kind of things. You don't have to go through as heavily. But nonetheless, like, you're ultimately going to end up with an inferior product. And probably 90% of the time, you're not even able to do it once you start doing in the due diligence on it. So going new construction, there's really two things that I'm trying to achieve. One is increased income. And by having specific size rooms, I mean, if you go look at places, right, there's bedrooms that are, you know, small, medium, large. Some have no bathrooms, some have half baths, some have full baths. My customer, again, we're in the middle class, upper middle class kind of customer area, right? They will pay an extra $1,000 a month more for, you know, a medium plus to large room with a private bathroom. If you offer them that versus a, you know, 12 by 12 kid size bedroom with no bathroom, like, that's $1,000 less, right? If I can have perfect size rooms and then dining rooms, do you know how much space you need for wheelchairs around a dining room? Like, you need so much space. The same with hallways, all of these areas, right? So I can increase my income and make potentially an extra $16,000 per month of top line income and have a mortgage payment that is maybe increased by $3,000-$4,000 a month. My payroll doesn't change. Most of my stuff, my utilities, none of that stuff changes, right? But by designing it a certain way, I can increase my bottom line by $10K. The other side of this, aside from income, is my staffing. Like, legitimately, when you were trying to convert a house and you take a normal sized dining room and you try and get a bunch of seniors around that dining room and like they're in wheelchairs and then one of them has to go to the restroom, like you can't get them out. Like, it just doesn't happen. So the amount of space that you need from a staffing perspective to, one, keep your staff so they're not overworked, they're not quitting. Ultimately, like, I don't want to get calls, right? I work 2 to 4 hours a week in my business, and it's because my staff are there consistent, right? I've solved all these problems, created system for it. My managers have a system to be able to run that. And a lot of these are problems that are physical building problems, right? There's just physically not enough space to transfer or to shower or a hundred different things. So I can solve a lot of these potential issues that will roll downhill to me by designing the building specifically how I like to design it.
Yeah, and I think that definitely plays, you know, a lot into even some of the things that people may not necessarily realize, just like you talked about, you know, having good staff that you can rely on. That's, you know, that, and that's the other equation to this. It's not just a real estate play, it's a business play. You know, you can build the building, but no one's going to want to come if, you know, you have the worst service imaginable. So having that, you know, well-staffed, well-thought-out things is definitely, you know, something people may not necessarily realize. And, you know, to that fact, if you have someone working there, they could be great, but if they have to move 8 people out of the way to get someone out of dinner to go to the restroom, you know, that could certainly play into, you know, employee satisfaction. If they get, you know, the ALF opens down the street that has, you know, new construction that's built well, it's like, I'm just going to take my, you know, my services elsewhere, if you will. So that's yeah, again, some of the things I like to kind of dig out of these kind of interviews is the things that people may not necessarily realize about this, that especially for, you know, different types of real estate classes of real estate, not real estate classes in the academic sense, but it's just the things that go into the back end that make a huge difference that you don't even realize. And if we can have someone on like you that can, you know, give a few of those nuggets so they don't have to take that very expensive class, you know, all the better. Now, to kind of transition a little bit to the back end of this, you know, when it comes to doing anything, you know, the world is run on money. You know, how does these things necessarily work? You know, what do, you know, the cash flows look like as far as, you know, a comparative analysis, you know, and again, secret sauce notwithstanding, you know, high level stuff is what we're kind of looking at for this thing. You know, what do cash flows look like for this? And then also, if people are interested in getting invested in this kind of thing, is this something that you go out with your own money and do, you know, cash acquisitions? Are you financing? Are you bringing in investors? You know, at least from your own experience, how do you kind of go out and do these things?
Sure. So I guess let me start from the numbers perspective and again, identifying what we do. We are trying to be the most expensive in town and have the best care in town and be the most gorgeous building in town. So from that perspective, That puts us right now, we're at about $8,000 a month. And again, we're outside of Austin, right? Some places that's super expensive. Some places in the country are, you know, more expensive than that. But again, I'm trying to match what is the most, what is the new construction big facility charging, right? And as the daughter is touring 5, 6, 10 of these, when she gets to Platinum Resort, which is my mansion, she's going to come in and we'll tour her and we'll say, hey, listen, mom's going to have her own private room, her own private chef. She's got a salon here. She has her own rolling, you know, shower, her own bathroom. We run 24-hour caregivers. We have couple managers. We have everything that she can get over there, she can get here. So why would you choose to pay the same price over there with 60 or 100 other grandmas and grandpas instead of doing it here? So from that perspective, you know, I think to be successful in this niche, you need to be over 100,000 in monthly income. You can get to that however you want to get there. But I think that's a really important line in the sand for me. Because if you're over 100,000, then you can have all of the expenses that you're going to need. And it's mostly all staffing. For us, we run 2 full-time managers for each one of our mansions. So literally every single day, there's somebody there, even on weekends, right? Like, a lot of the challenges of this industry are staff related. No call, no shows, people getting sick, all that kind of stuff. You just can't run short staff, right? It's not a Domino's where you can have like one less delivery person. You need people there. It's like literally people's lives, and you're taking care of them at 95 years old, where you have to literally change them and shower them and feed them, right? Like, you have to have the staffing there. So having 2 full-time managers, having the chef in the kitchen, if you can do all of those things, they legitimately cost, you know, a good amount of money to have great staff that are going to be there. So if you can be at 6 figures or above, then it puts you at a place where $40,000 is a pretty safe cash flow amount per month, right? I pretty consistently make about 40 grand a month. If you're in a lower market, it's pretty easy from this model, from a high end, 16 bed to do 30 grand. There are definitely areas where we're investing where, you know, it's $50,000+ a month in cash flow. And that's just the monthly cash flow, right? That's, after all the expenses are paid and I have all the staffing and building and taxes and all that kind of stuff. The real ticket here is the equity play, because you have really 2 businesses. You have a real estate company and you have an operations company. So you can go and sell these things, and we're building, you know, new construction. And again, we're about $2.2 million in hard cost to land, the building, and the site work on that perspective. Our appraisal came back. We're building this new neighborhood. So each one of our mansions, the appraisal came back at $5.1 million, and we have $2.2 in hard cost. And that's just on the real estate. Then the business came back, a business appraisal came back at about $1 million for each of those businesses. So we're building at less than 50% of cost. So we can talk about funding and stuff next, but really, I'm creating this retirement play for myself. This was really my goal, right? How do I do one deal that gets me $1 million plus, right? And this is how I do it. I'm going to cash flow the whole time. And then, you know, whenever I'm ready, I'm going to have my exit strategy. I can either sell the whole thing. I can rent these on a triple net to some, you know, national operations company. There's companies that don't own real estate. They just go around and rent these things. I can rent on a triple net that way. So there's a really big win in this, but I think that the income is so, so important, because that is the biggest variable. Your staffing, all that kind of stuff, it's going to stay roughly the same, right? You're going to pay roughly the same in most areas for these kind of things. But when you try and come in from the too small model, the RAO model, and you say, okay, well, watch, I'm going to make it an 8-bed work or a 10-bed work, and I'll just have one staff. Right, you're just gonna have one staff. You know what happens when your one staff doesn't show up on Christmas morning? You got to show up, right? Like, you literally have to leave your kids and drive over there, right? Because you have a bunch of grandmas with dementia that need your help, right? Like, you become a slave to your business if the numbers don't make sense. So I think that's my biggest thing that I like to stress to people, is you have to do the right numbers, right? And so people will say, well, yeah, you're in Texas, you can do that. Some states allow you to do that. No, you can do this in any state possible. The difference is that you just can't do it in residential type zoning. In every state, right? You can go from California over to Florida. You can have a 100-bed facility in every single state. There's no reason if you can't have 16-bed if you can have a 100-bed, right? It's just What's the zoning types? What hoop do you have to jump through? So that's really coming back to this model of new construction. This is why I will only do new construction. I'm trying to solve this problem. Have my income be high enough that I can legitimately provide the best care so that I don't get the calls in the middle of the night, so that I'm not a slave to my business. And ultimately, I can create a early retirement play with these kind of things.
No, it's definitely interesting that you're kind of creating an asset that the real estate is creating two different assets for you. You have an operational business side of things, and then you have the real estate as well, which you can either package or bifurcate when it comes time as far as an exit strategy, which is definitely an interesting concept, because it really is something that, there's other asset class, there's other types of real estate plays that can offer that same type of, delineation between having an operational side and a real estate side. You don't really get that with, commercial multifamily. You buy it, you occupy it, you sell it. You don't sell off the management of the building typically. Certainly are opportunities to do so. But it's definitely interesting. I would have never kind of thought it until you brought it up that really is kind of part of the, exit of these things. You could certainly own it in perpetuity, but, everyone wants to, kind of move on to the next thing at some point. Kind of bookend this, how does the financing of these things work? Is it something that at least you personally go out and just use internal capital? Do you bring in outside investors? Are you doing these things as investment grades where you're actually syndicating them, if you will? How at least do you go about, getting the capital to develop these?
So I'll speak for myself personally. I've done it three different ways. I've done it using private money. I've done it using a local commercial loan, and I've done it SBA. So I've never done a syndication. I really don't think that is the best fit for this, because the person who's running the deal, the operator, they don't get a big enough win in that type of deal structure to make it worth it. Honestly, I think you need a huge win if you're putting this deal together. If you're the one who has to get the call on Christmas morning and legitimately come in, you don't need a deal where you have 20 or 30%, right? You need a deal where you have 70%+. So for me, my first one, I raised all private money. And partly because I didn't know my numbers, right? I was going through the school of hard knocks, and it ended up being twice as much as I thought. So I raised private money and then had to go and sell properties to get the rest of it. But so I raised it that way. And then after about 2 years of owning the real estate, I went to the local bank and just refinanced it out, got some great, long-term financing on this. So that is an option for people. You can go and just, get a, 80%, 70% loan and do these kind of thing, but it's usually just against the real estate. And there are there's a good amount of other things that you need, soft costs and furniture and working capital, all those other things. So right now I'm using SBA. And I had said earlier that we're building these neighborhood of mansions that are about $2.2 million. So we're actually borrowing about $2.8 million per. So again, that's with furniture and fixtures and working capital, with interest reserves and lease-up reserves and all the fees and all that kind of stuff rolled into that. So SBA is actually a really great option for this type of business, because it's not just real estate. It's real estate and an actual operations company. So they'll lend against both of these separate entities. And if you find a lender who this is their niche and they know this space well, and you have experience with this, or you have someone on your team who has experience running these, then you can get these types of loans. And even in the last few months, as lenders have been more stringent, specifically there's two preferred lenders that we like to use, and I mean they're having no issues where they're lending to these things, and again they'll lend 85-90%. Of all of the funds that are necessary. And realistically, I mean, that whole thing, even if you're building new construction and then you have to get your license and then you have lease up and you're talking 18-20 months, there's some fantastic terms out there. Well, they'll lend you all of that interest reserves for that whole time. So it's the highest leverage way to go. But it really comes back to the deal. And again, from the perspective of I'm building at less than 50% of future value, there is, even if I'm highly leveraged in that perspective, I'm still pretty under leveraged because of what I'm building and what I'm creating.
No, that's definitely an interesting point. And it kind of goes back to the two-part approach to this of just being real estate and operations creating value in this whole scenario. So, notwithstanding, maybe it's a little bit more of a buffer for the terms of the financing than maybe just a traditional, having 16 beds in this type of ALF is much more feasible to go that way than just doing like a 16 unit apartment complex, because you really don't have that other portion of it that has a, it has a significant amount of value to it. Now with that said, unfortunately we're kind of running up a little bit on time here. So, you know, as far as closing thoughts on this, I think we've covered a great amount and I feel like we can probably go on for another hour. You've been a great guest. But if, you know, as far as kind of, you know, the identification of this, the lessons you've learned, what you're currently doing, and then the acquisition, I think it's pretty well packaged as far as, you know, information for people to maybe kind of get the, you know, if they're going to have the itch, you know, get it for this type of asset. Do you do any additional type of education or have any way for people to get in touch with you if they're interested in learning more or reaching out and doing this kind of investing themselves?
For sure. I would say the first and best thing to do is follow along on my podcast or my YouTube. So the podcast is Assist Living Investing, and then my YouTube is my name, Brett Schottkavis. And I'm literally just step-by-step unpacking my journey as I'm going through this thing and really just sharing, because ultimately 5 years ago when I first got into this, there was nobody doing this type of model. It was, here's a way to do the dinky little REL, and that was the only option. I'm like, well, I don't see a way for that. So let me share with people. And I'm just showing, here's everything that I'm currently doing. As I'm running these, as I'm expanding my business, I just go step by step and just share with people really so that they can have some type of roadmap out there, because I didn't see a roadmap for this type of model. So I would start there and follow me in those places.
Well, fantastic. And that's something I always encourage a lot of people to do is, you know, you don't need to go to some huge real estate seminar or, you know, ALF seminar. We certainly can. There's definitely value in there. But being able to kind of learn from people like Brett or being able to be exposed to this kind of thing is very important. You know, we talked about the classes that he learned on his very first deal of, you know, maybe why you don't want to renovate. And the fact that it's like, hey, the zoning board says okay, but the fire marshal comes knocking and now you have hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of issues. And, you know, people, if we can help people not have to have holding costs that are measured in number of houses you have to sell, I think we've been, we will have done something good with our time today. So Brett, I really do appreciate you being on with us today. The most valuable resource we all have is our time, and we can never make any more of it. So thank you very much for being on with us today.
You're welcome, Alex. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, this has been another edition of the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. My name is Alex Perney. As always, thank you and have a great day.
Thank you for tuning in to the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. Tune in next week for more investing tips and strategies.
Want to hear more episodes of the Alternative Investing Advantage? Search podcast at AdvantaIRA.com and subscribe.